Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. We're back once again this Saturday and Sunday. Happy to have you join along with us. We've got a big show today. All 2 hours are going to be jam-packed. Pamela, our producer, has been busy getting people on the phone for us and getting subject matter covered. And we've got a big subject today. We're going to explore Chef Terry's history a little bit today. We have two segments set aside.
What?
Since this is the last week of Terry's restaurants as we know them. I am not the one to say that you will never open another restaurant, because I
me neither.
I believe that there might be something small in your future.
I have no. You know, people keep wanting me to say yes to that, and I keep saying no for now.
No for now, exactly.
Let me take a break for a minute and recess.
You are a restaurateur through and through, and so it wouldn't surprise me for a minute if you didn't end
up back
in the
business. Okay, I'll keep buttering my toast.
Yes, you keep buttering your toast. So we're going to celebrate Terry's career here in Seattle, but also going to learn a little bit more about his adventure leaving France and getting to the States. The story I remember most is the taxi ride in Chicago.
Oh, that is a funny story.
From the airport. So we're going to tell that little story as we go. Speak of the season, blackberries and blueberries and huckleberries. Let's talk about what to do with those today. There's going to have a little cider summit. Pamela, when you say a cider summit, are you just Alan Shapiro is going to be explaining how to make cider?
No, for 10 years they've been having a gathering of cider producers.
Uh-huh.
So that's the summit from all over the world. But this year it's not going to be in person again, so he's making up tasting kits.
Oh, okay. It's interesting, you know, I watched the cider sales. People have been wanting cider to take off in this country for 25-30 years, and I've watched them just not sell at our restaurants. And then this year down at SeaTown, I'm there more often because I shuck oysters on the weekend, and we sell a lot of cider. I'm a little bit surprised. We go through a barrel maybe every 2 weeks.
Yeah. Do you have the Finn River?
Nope. We have Seattle Cider Company, I believe.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have a couple of cider, and we sell them too. And I'm very shocked by that, because I actually had to go back to buy more cider.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought we had enough, but nope.
Next week, just a little plug, we're going to have a little celebration of Alice Waters and Chez Panisse turning 50 years old.
Wow.
Looking forward to that and what kind of presence she's...
And I thought I was old.
Yeah, you are. You are, dude. We're going to check in with the book larder on the new books of the season. And, of course, we're going to finish up the show with our Rub With Love Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. My name's Tom Douglas. I'm chef owner of several Seattle joints, including the brand-new Carlisle Room has reopened. It's been open 3 days now. Actually, 4 days. Last night was the first night, Chef, that we didn't have to close because the hood actually worked. And we didn't smoke out the restaurant.
Yeah, these are the peripecies of opening restaurants, whether they're new, old, or reopening. Yeah,
there's always something.
There's always something.
Always something.
Now, you understand why I want to step aside, right?
No. Of course, SeaTown is open down there in the north end of the Pike Place Market. Hot Stove here, where we're doing our show. We are doing classes again in person and virtually. And then the Serious Takeout out in Ballard, 52nd and 14th in the Beer District, 14th Northwest. And, Chef, you are here for the last time, as we know it, as the chef owner of Luke Restaurant.
In Madison Valley. We got 2 days left as we are taping this show, and I'm looking forward to it. And everybody's coming in out of the woodwork to say thank you and goodbye. And it's been that's going to be my taste of the week. It's a bittersweet taste of the goodbye. And I'm very happy that I'm going to be able to step aside and do things I have another chance to do and catch up.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's kind of teary, and you get a little bit, it's hard to swallow when people start going through memory lane with you. And this is one table, and I see like 30 tables a night, and I'm like, oh my God, this is like, I need a drink.
Well, sometimes we put off, I think, we put off restaurants as being bourgeois sometimes. And I think that that's a short kind of, especially right now, maybe a thought that is out there a bit. You read it online, especially through our particular city council and things like that. But restaurants are important meeting places. They're places where people celebrate their lives, whether it's a business agreement or whether it's a wedding engagement. People celebrate in restaurants, and they also get nourishment. But when the people are teary with you, Cheery with Teary.
Yeah, Teary with Teary.
They are talking about the times that they've spent, the dates they've been on, yes. and the important birthdays they've had, maybe with their kids, or they're talking about that.
They're talking about their life through our lives, you know, through our place.
Mm-hmm. It's really sweet.
And, you know, it's very, very sweet. It's humbling. You know, you have to be grateful for this kind of memories build up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and also I try to explain to customers, they're only looking at me. I have to look at 10,000 of them. So it's a very different feel on my side because it's, you know, over and over and over, you hear the stories and they're like, oh, my God, this is so overwhelming. And quite honestly, I don't know about you, but I don't really look back. You know, I'm always running forward like you are. And now that I'm looking back, it's, Tom, I can't believe all the stuff we do in a lifetime.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling to look back and see what we have done. It's crazy.
And when you say you hear 10,000 of them, you're trying to process, you know, the 100 customers you have tonight who are telling you their stories.
Correct.
And they're processing their time that they've spent with you. And it's
correct.
It's an interesting thing. It's hard to process.
Yes, it's very hard. And it gets there is moments at night where I'm like, okay, I got to go off that table because they're starting to make me cry. I'm like, I got to move. You know, it's kind of, it's very, very, and, you know, thank you to all of you for the support over the year because it's a tango and I love to dance, but it takes two.
Yeah.
So we cannot do it without you. So thank you for the support. And again, what a beautiful ride.
What a beautiful thing. And like I said in the open, that we're going to spend a couple of segments on Terry's career here in Seattle as a restaurateur. Your life career is not over yet.
No.
But your restaurant career, maybe temporarily, is coming to an end. So we're going to celebrate how you got to the country.
Right.
And then from the next segment, we're going to take on, since you've been in Seattle, what are the highs and lows? And, of course, I see those two beautiful children of yours, and then there's nothing.
And they're in the
I'm not talking about Rovers and Luke. I'm
talking Ryan and Adrian.
Ryan and Adrian, and they're such a lucky man to have such nice kids. And
yeah, no, and they were both in last night, and they're going to be in tonight and tomorrow. It's very cool. Adrian is up front taking temperature dressed in a suit, and Ryan is bussing and
that's
helping.
Nice.
It's very
cool. I'll remind you that I did ask Terry for a reservation on the last night, and then he got me one. But unfortunately, he got me one 2 hours after the restaurant closed so that I could work in the dish pit.
In the dishwashing area, yes.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a good mopper.
Hey, so I know what you
can do. I appreciate the love, chef. I appreciate the love. When we come back, it's time for blueberries and huckleberries and everything in between. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. It's time to get out there and get to the farmer's market or get up to the mountains and get some huckleberries, some blueberries and blackberries from the farmer's market. You can even get blackberries in my backyard, and there's many backyards with blackberries Seattle.
You can pick the one in mine, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's fun to, as I drive across to the farm every couple of weeks to see everyone out on the roadside picking blackberries. You know, the hikers are picking, and some people actually pull their cars over certain spots. On this particular trip to Prosser last week, 20 elk on the, you know, there's wildlife overpass. Yeah, I could see 20 elk on the right side of the road there.
Really?
That was pretty cool.
The overpass is working.
Yeah, I didn't see them on the overpass because they have a, you know, you can't see that. But, yeah, I'm assuming that it was.
On their way
on the
up.
Ramp up. Wow. They were stopped to eat.
20 of them?
20 of them. And that's all I could see.
That's a beautiful
I'm sure
sight.
There were probably more.
Wow.
All right. Blueberries, huckleberries. I bought, when I was going over the pass this last week, there's a little roadside stand by the Drew Brew. Little tasting room there. And I got out because I saw the sign for huckleberries, and I was thinking it was probably like some bad huckleberry candy or something like that. And it was actually fresh, beautiful huckleberries from Forks, Washington.
Wow.
They were foraged, and a big bunch of the first chanterelles, nice, beautiful, dry chanterelles that I've seen this season, personally.
Oh, so they are out.
Well, they were expensive. I'll tell you that. They were $32 a pound for chanterelles. But they were super dry, which makes a big difference, right? They can be little sponges if you pick them after it rains.
It makes the pound a lot heavier.
Yeah, exactly. But beautiful huckleberries. And the first thing we made with the huckleberries is Jackie always keeps vanilla ice cream base in the freezer that when she wants ice cream, she can then just turn it. And so we had huckleberry ice cream with a little huckleberry syrup. And they were a little they weren't as strongly flavored as I was hoping for them to be. But I do think sometimes huckleberries are like coconut. People embellish the flavor sometimes with fake flavor ads. They're not always as flavorful as you think.
But also, I think then, like any fruit, if they're really ripe, they don't have as much flavor as when they are slightly under, where they have all that the tartness and all that woodsiness that you find. Once they get really ripe, they taste more like a confit fruit, you know.
It's and these were really ripe.
Right.
So blackberries, they're all over the place. Everyone's picking them. What are you going to do with blackberries this season?
Well, I just actually did something with blackberry. I made jam, which is something very different. But I made jam of blackberry with blueberry. Mm. And the two together, Pam, maybe you can comment on that because I gave you some.
It was explosive in flavor, deeply colored, and fragrant.
Yeah.
It was almost plummy.
But that's because both of the fruit were very ripe.
Okay.
The blueberry are from Woods Creek. In Monroe, there's a farm called Woods Creek Blueberry Pick Farm. So you go and pick your own blueberry. And those blueberries are not... You know, the one you have next to your farm, Tom, in Prosser, that I buy, too?
The Crawford.
Those are big blueberries.
Mm-hmm. The mighty blues.
The one that I use for that are much smaller, but they're so compact with flavor. It's crazy. And I was just there Monday night again to pick more. And really, really, they're getting smaller and smaller, like almost like a huckleberry. Mm-hmm. But the intensity in it is really beautiful right now because they've got all that sunshine through August. And I recommend, and if you have a weekend, this weekend, if you have time... You just go to Woods Creek Farm in Monroe, and you just go and pick, and it's like it's really cheap. I mean, you go and spend an hour with the kids. You pick like, you know, a gallon, 2 gallon bucket of blueberry, which is a lot of blueberries, and then you know it costs you like $3 or $5, whatever it is. It's really inexpensive.
And now, could you tell if that farm had irrigation or not? Because a lot of times, like the blueberries from the east side of, they're all irrigated, and they control the water content and the size of the berry. I mean, they also have certain berries that are bigger, but they also can really plump up those berries before harvest, right? Whereas if you're over here on the west side, like my blueberries in my backyard are not irrigated, and so they are what they are, depending on the how dry the summer has been.
Right,
and so they're small when they're dry. Right. It's they're smaller and more intense.
So this one, I don't think I haven't seen any big sprinkler or anything like this, but I do know there's a creek. It's called Wood Creek, obviously, farm. So there's a creek, and I know in the winter it overflows. So I don't know if they have water from that. That's how they get their water. The ground gets flooded and. You know, maybe they get all that humidity from that for the summertime. Mm-hmm. But I haven't seen any sprinkler, and I don't think Jay and Jane, who are the owner of that farm, are watering those plants. I think they're just doing it as it is. But I tell you, the fruit is really, really delicious.
Good.
So I recommend a two-hour trip to, you know, it's an hour or 45 minutes to get to Monroe. You get to that farm, and then you pick those berries for a while, and you come back home, and then you jam and you put it freezer on a sheet pan. You put it in the freezer. Next day, you put everything in a bag. You get blueberry every morning, frozen blueberry for your cereal, for your breakfast. Really healthy for your kids to take to school, to make muffins, to do all these different things. So, and the same with blackberry. We were just talking about blackberry. Same with blackberry. Just pick them and flash freeze them. All the ones that are overripe and melting down, you make a jam right away. Mm-hmm. Or puree, whatever, and you put that in the fridge and you use that in the next few days on your toast, on your cake. If you make a pound cake and you cover it with pureed blackberry and whipped cream, oh my God, you don't need anything.
Please.
You don't need anything else. It's very simple. It's not hard to make. You can even buy the pound cake if you're that bad.
I think that sometimes people don't use fresh berries in salads enough. So, if you make like a butter lettuce salad and you know, just a regular kind of salad, then hit it with, tomatoes, blueberries, whatever it is. But blueberries work just as well as a tomato does.
Of course.
In a salad like that. And then make a little, for sunset supper this last week, we just made a little tarragon mustard vinaigrette with the shallot mustard and tons of fresh tarragon. And it's really nice on fruit. I did it on top of melons and cucumbers, the Hannah's Choice melons. But same thing if you had blueberries. Or, you know, we love our corn and blueberry salad.
Of
you
course.
And I do with the basil and the mustard vinaigrette. Those are just the perfect things. Sometimes they get relegated to areas, and you don't think to break out of the sweet circle and get into a savory.
Yeah, and also, you know, like we often talk about pickling, a light pickle on a blackberry is delicious, and then you use that, you know, in the next few months with any kind of garnish for, you know, charcuterie or whatever. It's really nice. You put a little plate of salami and pâté outside on the table when your friends are coming over, and you put those pickled blackberry. It's really good. It's a nice bite. It's almost like a pic, like a cornichon almost.
I think you have to be careful on that particular angle. Like the wild blackberries, the weeds in your backyard don't pickle very well because there's not a lot of structure to the berry itself.
Yeah, they fall
Whereas
off.
Whereas when you're getting a cultivated blackberry, they hold up much better.
Correct.
For a pickling.
True. But, you know, when you're pickling, you can also pickle slightly on the ripe. You don't have to be, like, completely ripe. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones you can use for pickling because you're going to be cooking it slightly, you know, by the pickling. So it will still hold. And but, yeah, you're right.
The other thing I like, you know, for years I never made a fish stock or sauce or everything. I love roasted fruits mixed with something more savory, either like an ancho chili paste or a roasted jalapeno or something like that, where you can make sauces for a grilled piece of salmon or halibut or anything, even roast pork, right, would be delicious on a little. Or take that blackberry puree, stir in a tablespoon of mustard, and Pamela Hinckley will be at your house for dinner because she
waiting
loves,
at the door.
She loves her mustard, but a little blackberry mustard.
Oh yeah,
on a piece of pork chop or something.
Yes,
really
yes,
good. Really
yes,
good. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, there it is. No one would say after that. So, but you know, all those things—the blueberries, the huckleberries, the blackberries—they all work in that same kind of way and are delicious. Cherry mustard.
And really a little reminder: this stuff is free. It's on the side of the road. Go pick it and make it yourself.
Alan Shapiro is going to join us. He's the co-founder of the Cider Summit. Call and talk about hard ciders when we come back on the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society radio show from the Hot Stove Society kitchens here at the Hotel Andra in downtown Seattle. We are at 4th and Virginia. The hotel is very excited. They're getting ready to open here in the next week or so, and we're excited for that, too. It means we can start getting Lola worked on and maybe getting that opened up. Right now, we're going to jump into cider and all the different ciders that are happening around the Northwest. And Alan Shapiro is here. He's the co-founder of the Cider Summit, and he's we've called him to talk about what that is and why it's important and maybe a little bit about all the different kinds of cider that are in the marketplace out there. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you guys again.
Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Terry.
So, Alan, the Cider Summit has been going on for a long time now, and it seems to me every time I work down at SeaTime where I actually see each and every product that goes out, cider has become a mainstay in our beverage area. You must be thrilled about that.
It's been a great ride. We started the festival way back in ancient year 2010 in South Lake Union, and the mission really was to build awareness for a lot of these more artisanal cider products that were hitting the market. It was a pretty new category back then. And, you know, we started scrambling to find maybe 40 products from a dozen cideries that first year and, you know, not knowing if anyone would show up. And, you know, something like 400 to 500 people came that first year, and it really gave us some encouragement. And, you know, 10 years later, we were up to, you know, more than 50 participating cideries. Attendance approaching 3,000 people and, you know, about 175 different cider selections. So hopefully we've been a really good partner in growing the category in Washington and in the Northwest.
So tell us about the different kinds of cider that are out there and what is striking people's fancy. In our restaurants, we serve kind of what they call the semi-sweet cider, and that seems to be very popular. But I know there must be super dry and super floral and all sorts of different categories. What are the categories of cider?
Yeah, it's a huge range from, you know, bone dry, very elegant champagne style to semi-sweet that you mentioned to sweeter styles. And then there has been over the last handful of years, especially almost kind of in a certain segment of it, I would call like a craft beerization of the category a bit, where there's just this huge amount of experimentation going on with different botanicals and fruit additions and almost anything you can think of. And, you know what, and it really fit with the concept of the festival in that we wanted to give people this tasting opportunity, you know, an exploration opportunity, because it can be overwhelming You know, when you, you know, you're looking at, you know, 100 Chardonnays in a store, and, you know, and the huge selection of craft beer and ciders out there. So, you know, we publish this event guide for each festival and give people the opportunity to do a little homework in advance and decide, you know, what their interest was. Was it funky Spanish styles? Was it, you know, sweet, you know, styles from Brittany? Was it hop ciders? Was it fruit additions? And so while we have very much a regional focus to the festival traditionally, we've also wanted to represent the great cider making styles from around the world.
So the number one thing that to remember is it's not all apple. Is that what you're trying to say?
Right. So we predominantly it's apple, but it's apple with addition. There's pear ciders or perry as well. We even have had at the festival some apple spirits. And again, on the cider style, there may be, you know, watermelon or blackberry or raspberry or currant. And so cider makers have just enjoyed experimenting, especially with a lot of their own local ingredients. Mm-hmm. And it's been a great discovery process for the people that attended our festivals, you know, from 2010 to 2019. Before we kind of had to make the pivot to the festival to go tasting kits.
Tasting kits online, which is what you're going to do this year, correct?
Right. So we, you know, ran our traditional festival through 2019, always the weekend after Labor Day. And when the world changed in 2020, we made the most overused word of the last 18 months pivot mm-hmm. to festival to go tasting kits. And so this is, unfortunately, the second year in a row that we're doing that, coinciding with our Seattle festival. And so we've put together different selections each time, and we've got three kits available for purchase through September 1 if people are in Washington, or if they want to ship to other parts of the country, we need them to order by August 29th.
And where do they go to order? What's the website?
So they head to our site, which is cidersummit.com, and they will find all the info on the different tasting kits and can purchase right from there, or we'll direct you to purchasing for out of state. So there's three selections we've done this time. Our global selections, which is ciders from different, you know, the leading cider producing countries around the world. So we've got products from England, France, Germany, Spain, a beautiful cider from British Columbia called Sea Cider Bittersweet. And we decided it's global, so we'll include that far off Republic of California in there, Golden State Cider. We've got a kit that is Washington based. We call that our Washington Harvest Kit. And a new concept that we call Northwest Refreshers, which includes some apple-based seltzers from the area and a couple of lighter-style sparkling ciders, hard tea. And so there's really a variety of options for kind of all palates out there.
Boy,
that's great.
That business, Pamela, you were with Red Hook for a lot of years. That business is so splintered right now.
Seltzer, hard white claw, that whole category.
Yeah, and the million ciders, a million kinds of beer, and what you got out when the getting was good, I think.
You got out when there was only three, now there's 3 million.
But the cider category, I mean, it's, as you said earlier, it's having its moment, so it's so good consumers have so much choice.
Mm-hmm. We sell two kinds of cider. At our restaurant, the Schilling Cider from Fremont Brewery, and also the Seattle Cider Company Semi-Sweet.
Yeah, Seattle Cider is very popular around here.
What were you going to say, Alan?
I was going to say, well, so speaking of Seattle Cider, we actually have two selections in there. There's their sparkling papaya in our refreshers kit, and then I'll give you an exclusive right now in our Washington Harvest kit.
Oh, boy.
We added a breaking news, a seventh cider to that kit, which is listed as mystery cider, but it is the Seattle Cider Honeycrisp, which is a brand new product.
Oh, yeah. Honeycrisp is a great idea.
So we're excited about that. But it's been a really fun ride. I mean, you guys mentioned Red Hook and whatnot. I'm an old beer guy. I started in the craft beer business in 1989, and it was very, very, you know, early days then. Right. And so over the last, you know, 10, 12, 15 years with cider, it's been very similar you know, to that emergence as people just learn to discover these products are out there and try different tastes and styles. And it's been great to kind of be a partner in making that part of the beverage selection out there, as you were mentioning. It's just those, these categories are real and kind of part of everyday life now in this region.
People don't really know this, but our producer, Pamela, was on the opening team of Red Hook in 82. Is that right?
Oh, so long ago. So why long are you ago. Bringing that up?
And also, you know, she does
right out of high school.
She does have a flair for knowing what businesses are good out there. She also was on the opening team of Theo Chocolate. So
I just like the building.
Yeah.
The, you didn't want to leave the neighborhood.
I was president of the chamber, so I had to stick.
She had an interest.
All right. So again, Alan, let's remind folks of the CiderSummit.com. Is that right?
Correct. And on Facebook and Instagram at Cider Summit, and you can get all of the kit details there. And if you're in Washington State, you need to place your order for delivery or pickup by September 1. If you need it shipped elsewhere in the country, we need that order by August 29th at the latest.
Just to guarantee delivery. Yeah.
And then most of those ciders are available in all supermarkets, right?
Some are fairly rare and new in the Washington Harvest Kit. Right. That's another part of the fun thing is you're going to get a couple brand new and rare things that you can't find out and you can't find in a lot of markets.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Alan Shapiro from Cider Summit. And
my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Good luck.
Taste some of our agriculture right in your own. In front of your own Zoom.
Exactly.
All right. We'll be right back on Cairo Radio. We're going to take another segment to talk about how to cook with cider, because that is one of my favorite things to do. I just did a delicious bacon dish the other night.
Ooh,
so
bring on
the
bacon.
Let's talk about that. When we come back on Cairo, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show from the Hotel Andra here in downtown Seattle. Chef.
Yes. First thing that comes to mind, cooking with cider,
cooking
right?
Cooking with cider, yeah. We just got our taste whetted in the previous segment about the big Seattle Cider Summit. Let's cook with cider a little bit. And I'm going to jump right in to my taste of the week that I didn't talk about way back when. But the other night for our knife and fork salad, you know, Carlisle just opened. It's been open four days now. And one of the things on the menu, it's a very kind of Americana tavern kind of menu right now. And one of the things is a knife and fork salad, and we do a nice slab of iceberg lettuce as our base, drench it in ranch dressing, and then garnish it with a few things like beautiful heirloom tomatoes from Prosser Farm, and I made spicy goldfish. Remember I told you about my spicy goldfish last night? I sautéed the Pepperidge Farm goldfish in cayenne pepper, bacon fat, and butter.
So please pay attention. This is very important.
I already had one dish sent back saying they were too spicy. and then some little toasted shallots. But then we also put on a braised chunk of bacon. So I get slab bacon, and I cut it in these little chunks, and then I braised it in cider, a semi-sweet cider. So one part cider to one part cider vinegar.
Right.
Because I want, not a whole part of honey, but maybe a quarter part of honey.
Right.
Because I want that sweet sour thing going on, and then I put star anise pods in there, cover it with foil.
Oh yeah!
Put it in a 275 degree oven for 3 hours, and that smoky bacon just braised out, and now it's like fall apart deliciousness.
Oh my God!
Really good with the spicy little spicy goldfish.
So what do you do with the juice?
The juice, I just do the next batch of bacon in.
Okay.
Yeah, you can just keep turning it over.
Because I've done things like this before.
Well, you can glaze it, right?
Yeah. Well, what I do is I reduce it down, and then. But the difference between you is instead of the cardamom, I put pieces of apple.
I put star anise, chef.
Oh, star anise, pardon me. You did say, I thought you said cardamom too.
No.
Star anise, okay.
I put
cardamom in mine. How's that? How about that? Anyway, I put I take quarters of apple and I put them all around the pork belly. And I braise it like this. And at the end, I blend the whole thing, the juice. But I use raw cider. I use very, very, not sweet. Very harsh cider. And then pieces of apple. And then you blend the whole thing together with Dijon mustard. And then you put this all over the bacon slab, the slice, when you're done. It's disgustingly good.
My God, what was that little giggle we just heard? Yeah, I'm not sure.
Well, because it's really good. It's really, that was a bowl of cider or a glass of cider. Mm. And then the other way I like to use cider is when I make crepe. You know, if I make savory crepe, I like to use cider as a liquid as opposed to milk or whatever. So you use buckwheat and you use apple cider, raw apples.
That's very much Brittany, isn't it?
Very, very.
Normandy, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very much. And when you go in a crêperie in Normandy, which is a restaurant, when it's not a crêperie like a stand, it's actually a restaurant where they have a menu of savory and sweets. And all the savories are made with buckwheat crepe. Mm-hmm. And they use cider to use into the batter. It's really delicious because it really enhances that flavor of yeastiness, and because you get that strong yeastiness. And you drink that with a fresh, raw cider, a bowl of cider. They give you a bowl and they put it on the table. And you drink the cider like that. Oh, my God, it's so delicious. Mm. It's a very, you're definitely in an apple-style kind of dinner, you know. And then you finish that with a nice little Calvados, which is an apple brandy. And like, yeah, no, you're good.
It's interesting that, you know, so many things have traveled the world when it comes to wine.
Right.
And even some beer, if you look at beer halls. But you don't see cider traveling as far as outside of the beverage itself. You don't see the cider creperies, the Brittany style. Right. What's the name of that flower? You just said it.
The buckwheat.
Buckwheat flower crepes. You just don't see that as a restaurant setting very often. There was one up on Capitol Hill for a while. I don't know if they're still around. That creperie, what's it called? Like Superior Crepes or Super Crepes or something like that.
Yeah, no, I think that crepe is a very cultural item. You know, I think it's very much a very singled out item. And unfortunately, the sweet have traveled, the savory have not followed as well. But I tell you, if you ever go to Normandy in France and you're driving through the countryside and you see those wood sign, hand-painted creperie sign, and it's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you're in the middle of the field. And then you stop and you park into that field. There's 150 cars in that field. You're like, what the hell? Where are these people coming from? And then you go into that place, and you can't believe it. It's like opening the door, and then you have like two floors of like people in different rooms everywhere, and you know, ladies and men carrying like stacks of like plates. And you're like, what the heck? Where am I? You're in a village. You're like in the middle of nowhere in the countryside, and yet everybody comes here because that's a very cultural, traditional area kind of thing, and all of France know what a crêperie is in Normandy. And that's a restaurant where they specialize in the crepe as a vessel, but everything else goes in there. You get like a nice roasted chicken, bechamel and mushroom kind of crepe. It's really delicious. Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back to cider.
Okay.
we got a roasted chicken.
Okay.
How would you make a cider glaze for a roasted chicken?
So I would just take the cider and I would put honey, because we have beautiful honey around here.
But if you're using a sweet cider, you wouldn't do that, right? But
right.
You're saying, like, are you using a hard, dry cider
Correct.
If you're going to do that? Okay.
Anytime I cook, is usually I start with the lowest denominator so I can add my goods to it instead of starting with the sweet. So I start with a raw cider or harsh cider, no sweetness in it. Then I add to it. So I add the honey. I put a little dash of vinegar, depends on the level of acid in my cider. I reduce it down to a very nice glaze, not too much, but all the way, probably at least by half. So you have an unctuous feeling to it. I roast the chicken.
Can I stop you there for 1 second?
Yep.
Because I think people get confused sometimes when they reduce wine, they reduce cider. You have to do it on a fairly low heat.
Correct.
Or you burn the cider and the wine to the side of your pan and you alter the flavor
Correct.
Of it.
You get bitterness.
Yeah.
So go. Start with high heat, bring it to a boil, then reduce it down to a low simmer.
Yeah.
And then let it go. And it takes a while. You have to be patient. And then
But once it goes, you got to watch it.
You just make sure you don't burn it. And then you just roast your chicken to a crisp. And then once your chicken is ready, you brush the glaze only at the last minute. And you flash it in the oven for about 2 minutes at 400 degrees. And that creates that seal right away on top of that crust. If you process it differently, it's going to wet the crust and it's going to soften it down. But if you do it fast, like a broiler or like a 450-degree oven, you have no problem in 2 minutes to have that glaze really nice and stick to the skin and keep the whole complex of crispy skin, sweet and sour kind of idea on the outside. And then, of course, when you roast the chicken, why not throw in a bunch of cut apple quarters into the chicken with a little bit of sea salt, a little bit of rosemary, and then keep that into the chicken. Those apples are going to be delicious when they come out.
You know what we're harvesting right now? It's just starting to head up is our cabbage. And I was just thinking that roasted chicken with the cider glaze and then just slow sautéed, not braised. Sautéed cabbage. If you want to braise it, then go ahead and use cider to braise it in, like make it more like sauerkraut.
Right.
But I'm talking about pan roasted cabbage.
Absolutely.
That is a vegetable that just doesn't get used very much, and it should, because it's so, once it wilts a bit, it's super tasty.
Yeah, and right now they're tender as tender can be. It's really delicious.
So put your, you could also put your apples and your cider in that and cook that with that your, underneath your roasted chicken.
Apple cider, good with sausages, good with, I mean, it's good with a lot of meat. It's also good with desserts, of course. We haven't talked about a good tartatin, where you do a caramel of cider, where you make a caramel and you deglaze your caramel with cider. I mean, or you could reduce your cider and add it to your caramel at the last minute with some whipped cream and a little Calvados glass on the side and shot of Calvados. Nice slice of tartatin.
Take me there.
Seems like a lot of Calvados going out this morning at the Hot Stove Society radio show. Calvados being the fabulous apple brandy from the Normandy area, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And you can actually find local. Clear Creek out of Oregon. There's some good local apple brandies, too. It's time for hour number two. Stay with us. Got a big show. We're going to learn a little bit about Chef Thierry and his travels, his journeys to the States. And then after that, maybe a little bit about his time here in Seattle as he wraps up his restaurant business here in on the 28th, right? August 28th.
Yep.
So that's when we come back on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to hour number two of the Hot Stove Society radio show, coming to you from the Hotel Andra and the Hot Stove Society Cooking School here in downtown Seattle. My name is Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And we are bidding Thierry's businesses, his restaurant business life, sweet adieu for a while. Maybe forever, but maybe not. Never say never, right?
Who knows? Never say never. Never this say is America. Never. There's always a... You know, there is always something going on. So we have opportunities, we have chances. But for now, I'd like to take a break for a little while and recess and, you know, see what's going on. And it's all beautiful.
It's all beautiful. Also in this hour, we have Laura Hamilton from the Book Larder in Fremont to tell us the new books that are out and about to start to think about for your holiday gift giving. Because, you know, the biggest book season starts really kind of the end of September.
Right.
All the way through the holidays as far as new cookbooks go. And, of course, we're going to wrap up the show with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Always a good time. And if Pamela is on her game today, we will have all questions about Thierry Rotiro.
She's not on
her game.
Win.
She's not on her game. I might win. I might not win. Who knows?
All right, Chef. We've been doing this radio show for about 20 years. We've been friends for quite a long time. We met in the restaurant business when you first bought your restaurant here in Seattle. But let's go back further than that. You're a young chef, or actually probably only a cook at that time. Right. I don't know. But
yes.
You apprenticed when you were 14 years old in a restaurant in
Anjou, in the town of Cholet.
Right.
I did a two-year apprenticeship, which, by the way, was a very memorable thing to never do again.
Tragic, yes.
Very, very tragic. It was, it was horrible. It was like I was shaking like a leaf every day. I was a little, I mean, I was 5'5", and I was, 20 pounds. Mm-hmm. I was a 14-year-old kid and thrown into this life of wanted to work, wanted to make my own money because, you know, I come from a poor family, and asking for a quarter to daddy every Sunday was a pain in the neck because he would always say, why do you need a quarter for? And I was like... You know, I want to go to the movies. We have a TV right here. What do you need to go to the movie for? I'm like, okay. So did a two-year apprenticeship and then eventually graduated from that and then moved on to different parts of France because that was the trajectory after that. It was like, okay, I don't definitely want to stay here. I want to try something else and I want to try to see if there is a still, am I going to like this profession? Because right now I really want to quit.
Why didn't you join the French Foreign Legion if you wanted to see the world? Why chefing?
You know, I was never that guy.
I know.
I was never that guy to take orders. I think I was more built to give orders, just like you.
All right, so you've traveled around France.
So I went to the Mont Saint-Michel first for 7 months. I did a season there, a summer season, in a restaurant called Le Saint-Michel, right in the middle of the way up to the top of the Mont Saint-Michel. And by the way, I lived in the Mont Saint-Michel. There's 21 people that live in the Mont Saint-Michel. I was one of them. I had a little room and board. I had a room with a sink, and the shower was somewhere else. And that was in the rocks, and that was my room. But I was very proud to live in the Mont Saint-Michel.
Yeah, very nice.
Very cool. And so that was, and the people were super nice. The chef was very young at the time. He was 28. So we had a great time. So then I moved to Chamonix in the Alps to go do a winter season. Mm-hmm. And that's where I learned to ski, number one. And then I learned to cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner because we were doing food for kids that were coming on vacation from Paris. And they would stay for a couple of months and do school in the morning and skiing in the afternoon. So that's what I was doing there. And then I moved to from Chamonix to Andai in the Spanish border of the Basque country. So it was really very nice discovery. I love that area of the world. It was beautiful. The food, really nice. I mean, the peppers, the all that discovery of those new ingredients that mm-hmm. we didn't have commonly where I was coming from. That was really cool to learn all that. And different style of cooking, different weather, different, you know, just different life. And the fish, too, were a little bit different. So that was.
So when did you get on the plane to Chicago?
So then I went to do a year of army time. And then end of 1978, I come out of the army. I'm broke. I had no money. I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to look for a job. And in the local paper, which is about 3 pages big, my hometown, there is a small square that says looking for cook in USA. And I'm like, oh, why don't I just call that? You know, I called a guy. He's 20 miles away. He's a restaurateur in Chicago who has a restaurant in Chicago and on vacation at his parents' farm 20 miles away. So I drive there with my mom and go see the guy. And obviously, he's a good salesman. So he sells me this job that I'm going to come to America and I'm going to make, I don't remember, like $700 a month. We're talking month salary because in France, that's how we pay. You know, like $700 a month, your hotel is going to be $25 a week. You know, so as you're 20 years old, you're like, okay, so 700 minus, oh, okay, cool, I'm going to have some money left. I'm just going to go there for 3 months and 3-4 months and then, you know, figure it out. He's like, oh, yeah, don't worry, it's so easy. He make it sound so easy. I was like, cool. He gave me his phone number and he writes it down in English style. We saw all the sevens were looking like ones to me at the time because there was no bars on the bottom. So when I recopied the number, obviously I got the wrong number, right? And that was the beginning of the story without knowing. Then I wrote him a letter to pick me up at the airport, when and where and this and that, because we didn't call at the time. And, of course, I land in O'Hare Airport. So I'm 20 years old. I land at O'Hare Airport. I don't speak English, or I think I do, but I don't. And sure enough, he's not there. First of all, it took me 20 minutes to have a guy at the border asking me to open my suitcase, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. That's when I knew I was really, really messed up with my English. Then I walk through the airport, and I'm asking people for money, because in French, the word for change is money. And I forget, I'm jet-lagged. I have a $20 bill in my hand, and I'm asking people for money. So, of course, they're moving away from me, like, this guy is crazy. And eventually, it said, works. Numbers doesn't work. I go outside with my little black book, and I'm showing a yellow cab, the taxi driver. I'm showing him the address. I get in the cab. I sit in the cab. And this is the old taxi where they have like four different layers of zeros going
meters,
at the same time.
The meters are running, yeah.
Yeah, the meters. And it's got the comma in the middle. And I'm looking at these numbers, and suddenly I freak out. I'm like, oh, my God, $700, $800, $900. I'm like, oh, my God. I came with $450. I'm like, oh, my God. They told me it was expensive here, but I didn't realize it was that expensive. I was sweating bullets, and we got to Clark and LaSalle, bottom of that building. The guy turned around, and he went, $12. And I was like, oh, I understood that. I was like, oh, my God, it wasn't $1,200. It was $12. I gave him $20, and I felt like the richest guy on the planet. I was like, yes. Anyway, that was my entry to America. And
you found this guy. And you went
I found this guy. And then the next step is bottom of the building. The guy wasn't there. He wasn't. It took him hours to get here. He wasn't there. So I made friends with the portier, the gentleman who was at the door, African-American man who had been to World War II, speak a little bit of French. So we became buddies right away and talk. And I said, you know, I'm really hungry. A restaurant? He's like, he sends me around the corner. I go into this place. And I see a sandwich, you know, like there's a menu hanging, and I see the word sandwich. I'm like, sandwich. I get this thing. I was starving. I get one bite, and I'm like, oh, I almost threw up. I was like, what is this? What is this flavor? I've never had this before. This is, what is that?
What was
I could
it?
Not eat it. RBQ.
RBQ or barbecue?
RBQ sandwich.
Arby's restaurant?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was my introduction to food in America.
You are such a snot. When we come back, we're going to learn more about how Terry made it all the way to Seattle and a little bit more about his history here and wrapping up Luke Restaurant in Lule here in downtown Seattle. It's Tom and Terry on the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rogero, the chef in the hat.
And we're celebrating Terry's last week in the restaurant business for the foreseeable future. I'm not willing
now
to. The time is done.
The end is near. As I'm looking at my stove burning.
Okay, let's move on. So, Terry, in the last segment, we heard about your apprenticeship. You made your way around France cooking in restaurants. You fell in with some fly-by-night operator out of Chicago.
Correct.
Who was visiting his mother in France.
Yep.
Dude, you were so gullible. And then, so you get off a plane in O'Hare, you almost go broke in the taxi ride. This guy's a flake. He doesn't pay you.
Yep.
And you happen in to a French restaurant.
French restaurant, La Fontaine, and that's where I started my career in America.
And you actually got paid.
Yes, and they were super cool. They were super nice, those guys.
All right.
Three French guys. And had a fabulous time there. Learned Spanish before I learned English because I work with three Mexicans that didn't speak any English. Mm-hmm. Typical restaurant. And then I learned English, and I was illegal for 2.5 years, and then I got my green card, and the whole shebang came back that way. And then 3 years later, I met Cyril, mm-hmm. who came and worked in that restaurant as well. That's where we became friends and best buddies for like 35, 40 years now. And then I moved to Los Angeles after 3.5 years with Cyril. We moved together at the same time. And then in Los Angeles, I worked at the Regency Club and met some really cool chef and very nice food and really fell in love with more and more with my profession and really enjoy. It's like anything else. If you have a knack for it or if you like the creation of it, I think the passion was really intense, and I really loved that. I was like, now I know I can do this, and I love this,
How did you end up finding the Rovers restaurant that was owned by Mr. McKenzie?
So I came to Seattle to visit Cyril, who had moved up here with Kathy, and then we went to this place that was just reviewed in the LA Times called Rovers, and talked to Kevin, and Kevin was like, oh, man, I'm tired of this town. They don't know anything about food. I need to go back to Los Angeles. And I was like, you should take it easy, man. You've just been 10 months. I mean, it's like, that's not even a time. And he's like, no, I need to get out. And I was like, okay. So bought the restaurant and started August 3rd, 1987, in a restaurant called Rovers, just before I turned 27, and never looked back.
Yeah.
And the rest is history. I mean, the ride of 26 years at Rovers, high intense life. Obviously, as you know, Tom, it's a nonstop, 24/7 kind of life. Mm-hmm. But it was so cool. I mean,
you traveled the world.
To get my yows out is what I always said. I was able to get my yows out. It's like to create and to do this on your own term. Because it wasn't about becoming rich, but it was definitely about, I'm going to do it my way.
And how fast, I don't remember, but in the beginning, you kind of took over Rovers and the menu was not similar.
I didn't change anything the first 2 months.
You partnered up with a couple. You and Kathy partnered up with another couple.
Right. From Los Angeles. She came with me.
What was her name? Diane?
Diane.
And then that didn't work out so good. So you had to, you changed quite a few things. You went from an a la carte menu, which is, if you don't know, an a la carte menu is you if you want the beef, you order the beef. If you want the salmon, you order the salmon. Until you morphed in, how many years later, into a, this is the menu we're serving tonight.
Correct. So it took me about 5 years to get off the ground. It was a miserable road up. Oh, it was hard.
It's hard, yeah.
It was very, very hard. And it took me about five years. I bought my partner, I think, after 3 years, Diane, mm-hmm. bought her out. So I was solo, and it was a rough road. But then one day I was just tired of doing all this little knick-knack, and I was like, okay, if I'm going to do this and be that poor doing it, I'm at least going to do 100% what I want. So I started doing 8-course menu, 5-course menu, and 5-course vegetarian, and never looked back. Mm-hmm. And then what I made, that was not very French, but very cool for most people, is all the items were available a la carte. So you could order the menu, or you could order a la carte, which is the cool thing to do. It was a little bit harder for us, but it was definitely a great way to get the customers in and to more approachable, basically. Mm-hmm. But it was an incredible road to be able to do. I mean, at the beginning, I was definitely working from... there was never enough hours in a day. Mm-hmm. Started at 8 o'clock in the morning with a triple espresso, and then never looked back until 1 o'clock in the morning. And you were like, damn, I still have so much stuff to do.
Okay, so now you're in Seattle. Yep. You fell in love with Seattle?
Love Seattle. So my entry to Seattle was Kevin McKenzie taking me to the old owner of Rover, taking me. I'm like, I need to meet your producer at the market. We go to the market. We meet the producer. We will go through Frank's Produce Socio at the time, all those guys, and Mama Melina. I mean, not Mama Melina. What was her name?
Pasquale.
Pasquale. You know, and all those people, super cool, Don and Joe's. And then the first chef I met, of course, in Seattle was you.
Mm-hmm.
Walk up to the Cafe Sport, and he's like, do you want to meet a chef? I'm like, sure. And first thing I meet is Tom Douglas. And man, that was like, I was like,
what
really?
A happy occasion.
Really? I was like, no, it was good. He was writing a menu.
He trashed my food.
He was writing a menu with a marker, and he was...
I know, every day I wrote the menu.
He was totally trashed. His apron was dirty as hell, and I was like, who is this guy?
T-shirt and shorts. That's what I have always worn, T-shirt and shorts.
No, of course. But, I mean, you know, I'm coming from the old school.
You were in your whites, walking through the market in your whites, which I find hilarious. Last time I did that, I was about 19 years old, and I got whistled at, and that was the last time I wore my whites. One of the produce vendors whistled at me. He was like, okay, I'm not doing this again. Okay, so then Rovers came to its conclusion. You went a little bit more casual, and you did Luke in the same building, but business
next
door.
Next door. Basically, we opened a bistro 3 years before we closed. With the end of the lease of Rovers, we opened a bistro next door. Luke. And Luke is finishing, obviously, Saturday, you know, tonight, 28th of August, and 11 and a half years later. So lease is down. And then, of course, in between, or after that, once we closed Rovers, we opened 3 months, 4 or 5 months later, we opened Lule downtown, which we just closed because, as you know, Six and Union is not really happening. So here we go.
So here you are. And then what do you suppose... I mean, I know you're going to go out to some music festivals. You're going to go see Willie Nelson. You're going to get in your car and drive a bit. What excites you about food today that excited you 40 years ago when you got started?
Well, the thing that excited me the most is to know that what excited me when I started going to Pike Place Market, looking at all those vegetables, just like in the old country, you know,
it's right?
Like
just all the markets
seeing
around France.
All that, is still existing times 10 today. That's what excites me, is we have made progress. We're not there yet, but people definitely are looking for food provenance, who's making the food, how is it made. There is more and more questions asked about the food, which is the only way we're going to be able to get out of that, you know, production of bad food. You know, it's like people need to ask questions, and they need to want it. They need to want it for their own... in their own goodness, you know. It's like you can eat as much as you want of good food. It's definitely not going to mess you up as much as if you eat bad food.
Well, see, yeah, I eat plenty of bad food too, but that's just the difference between
you
and me.
You balance it out.
I sort of don't. But I do think that's important, what you just said, which is that people can't, they have to stop putting their head under the pillow and recognize that their choices make, you know, their food choices make a world of difference to the people who are trying to grow
to their neighbors,
organic,
to everything,
to manage fisheries, to life in general. Yeah. Absolutely. So,
and also part of survival, we're going through a time right now, COVID. It has shown us how many people feel so, you know, they feel so lost because they don't know what to do, how to do, whatever. You know, it brings you a little sense of confidence when you know where things come from and when you grow it and everything. At least you get that survival kit in you. You know, it's like, I think it helps to do this kind of stuff. So, but more importantly, thank you so much. Thank you, Seattle, for the support over the year. Nothing but lots of love to all of you. And I'm not dying. I'm not dead. And I'm definitely going to be around. So... You know, it's
well,
just,
Pamela has already told you today that she wants to hire you as our karaoke leader here at the Hot Stove Karaoke Cooking Party.
There we go. We have so much fun.
It's going to be nothing but fun.
You're the bandstand leader.
Champagne and singing. Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
But you have to do everything in a Louis Armstrong voice.
Oh, no.
He does a good Louis Armstrong.
I know it.
Laura...
The fans are clamoring for your cookbook. Are there any copies, any possible way?
Amazon.com is the only place I know where you can find them.
They still have them?
Used.
Well, there is some used on the web, yeah.
Okay.
I think the price goes from like $3 to $100, so just pick up your own price.
Exactly. I've got 6 or 8 copies in my thing that I'll sell, you know, Less than 100, maybe. More than 99, less than 100.
Bring some
change. Laura Hamilton up next, the owner of Book Larder on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. Right. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And we are joined by the fabulous Laura Hamilton over at the Book Larder bookstore in Fremont. Not Freelard, in Fremont, Seattle.
Fremont proper.
Fremont proper, yeah, exactly. Welcome to the show, Laura. Welcome back, I should say, as our resident cookbook expert.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I love doing these segments.
I was just asking you off air if you had any of Rover's books around, because, you know, it's not like Terry's dead, but still with the restaurants going away, people are acting like he's dead, and they all want a copy of his book. They think it's going to be worth a lot more money now.
So if you have any, say you don't have any and just wait another week, double the price,
yeah,
and then
we'll
you make some money.
There we go. I was going to say, I think people should be holding on to them then, right? If they are very valuable. I won't see one for years now.
This is the time of year we're starting to get ready for the holiday book season. I don't think there's too many that are coming out in August. Maybe I'm incorrect in that, but I always think of the book season kind of beginning the middle of September and going through November 15th as far as the releases go. What's out there? What should people be looking for? And what's got your fancy?
Yeah, so I have some books today that I feel like are good ones to sort of wind down summer with, that are new releases that really take advantage of our gardens and also are very travel-inspired. So the first one I have is a book from the Baltic states, actually, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. It is called Amber and Rye, and it's by an author called Zuza Zak. It's a really beautifully photographed, delightful book. It's the first one that I've seen in English that really covers this area and gives it sort of a big, beautiful format as well. The cuisine itself, I would say if you are a fan of Scandinavian cuisine, you will love this book, and it will help sort of open some new horizons and new ingredients for you. It's a lot of very vegetable-focused things, but then with things like poppy seeds and coriander and actually hemp is one of the key ingredients of this area. So if you've got hemp seeds flying around because someone told you they were good for you, there's some really good recipes in here that use those.
Now you know what to do with them.
Exactly.
I like because somebody told you it was good for you. They always tell you it's good for you when you buy it.
So where's the amber and rye come into the equation?
So those are two of the ingredients. So rye is a key ingredient. And then there are also ingredients like buckwheat and things like that. So it's, and also actually sea buckthorn, which is an ingredient that we're starting to see a little bit more in the Pacific Northwest now that I hope we continue to see. Mm-hmm. But it offers this sort of lovely amber sort of color to all kinds of things as well.
Yeah, rye is just such a delicious. I love those kind of boiled breads that come from that area.
Yeah, totally. It's a really great book. And all the books I'm talking about today are obviously available at booklearner.com.
There you go. All right, what's up next?
The next one I have is an Italian baking and sweets book from a British author called Letitia Clark. She actually lives in Sardinia. And this book is, again, like all three of the cookbooks I have today are beautifully photographed. They will, you know, make you want to add new destinations to your travel list for when we can all start doing that in a safer way again. It's a really lovely collection of Italian recipes, baking, tarts, biscuits, all those sort of things. I think my favorite chapter is the one that is called, now I have to find it, it is called Sweets by the Spoon. So it's like panna cottas and tiramisu and all those like creamy, delicious things that you eat with a spoon that I think Italians do so well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really, again, like lots of fruits in this book. So if you're looking for things to do with your peaches, apricots, figs, pears, you know, lots and lots of delicious ideas for using all that lovely seasonal fruit too.
There's so many Italian dessert books out there. What kind of separates this? It's just from the Sardinia area?
Yeah, it's from that area. And it's also, I think, because she has that sort of outsider looking in view, even though, you know, she lived there. She was a chef at Moro in London, which is like one of their sort of best loved restaurants. She also is, I think, very good at translating the region and its cuisine for readers who might not have ever been there or have a more sort of British or American point of view.
Sometimes you do need to look at it with an outside
right.
set of eyes to really see or show the locals what is so special about their own place.
Correct. And also to show the reader a little bridge to be able to get there. Because if you get somebody from there writing to you, it's not going to translate the same way as if you have somebody who is looking at it from the outside. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, it's cool.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a beautiful book. We actually have a virtual event with her on September 1st. She's going to be in conversation with Amiko Davies, who's another, she's Australian, but another Italian transplant. So, yeah.
Cool.
And then my third book is by Gil Meller, another British chef. It's called Root, Stem, Leaf, Flower. It is seasonally organized. Seasonally organized, but then also within the seasons organized by ingredient. And so this is one of those perfect, you know, you want to try out new things at the farmer's market. You've got a glut of something in your garden and you need ideas for it. This is a perfect book for that. He has a very simple approach to his recipes in that most of them have very few ingredients. And so, again, like they sort of really take advantage of that freshness and that perfect time of year sort of thing. It's another book with great photography. And they also did these really interesting photos. If you're someone who really likes to read your books and views them as, you know, like things you like to work from and also as art, he's also a poet. So he has poems about various ingredients. It's so good. And he and his photographer use some really unusual methods it's impossible to describe on radio. You really have to see it. But to photograph the vegetables and make them look really extraordinary. Hmm. So it's just a really lovely, very usable and very beautiful.
Anything jump out at you in that book that, you know, you've seen every book on the planet. Anything jump out at you that you want to try first in this late summer market area?
Yeah, you know what? I went straight to the summer. So like he has, if you like Eat and Mess, that sort of cream and crushed up meringues and fruit, his version has blueberries, honey, and lavender, which is really lovely. He also does some really nice things with broccoli, which I know sounds really.
Oh, I need
but I
ideas
get so bored
for broccoli.
With my broccoli.
Yeah.
I bet you a million people want to hear this.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But he makes these, in the UK, they do a lot of purple sprouting broccoli, but it would just be like that, the sort of those tender, thin stalks of broccoli. He makes pancakes out of them and fills them with celeriac and mushrooms.
That's how you make the children eat the broccoli.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. But like a whole roast broccoli with honey and seeds that I've made that's absolutely wonderful and incredibly simple.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah,
you'd be surprised sometimes who likes broccoli. I mean, I'm a broccoli nut. I love it.
Yeah, you are.
But
I was sitting outside. I had brought Jackie lunch out at the farm, and we were sitting on the picnic table out there, and a couple of the cats came up and jumped on the table, so I gave them a little piece of the chicken, and they kind of smelled it, sniffed it, and batted it away, and then they put their head right into my to-go container and pulled out a piece of broccoli and ate the entire piece of broccoli. A cat did.
What?
So, you just never know. Broccoli is one of those things that can get to
skip. Yeah.
I just don't want to be around that cat in about an hour.
No. Oh, no. Yeah, I have a cat who eats everything, so that story was fairly terrifying. Tom. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And he slurped up noodles like we would slurp up noodles. It was like, he just kind of slurped up.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was actually, Tom, that was an excellent segue. If you have 1 second, are we
yes,
done?
Yes, we have about 30 seconds. Go for it.
Okay, so Crying in H-Mart, if you are looking for a great food memoir.
I was wondering what that was about.
So wonderful. So she's Korean American, and the title basically comes from an essay she did for the New Yorker that launched the whole book, where her mother had died. She goes into H-Mart just like to pick up a couple of ingredients and has this whole like breakdown realization of like the connection that her mother had to food that she had missed and all of, I mean, it's just an incredibly emotional story. And the book is really her sort of rediscovering cooking and using that as a connection back to her mother and her culture and just a part of herself that she had not appreciated, she feels like, when her mother was alive. And so it's just a wonderful read. When I told someone on staff I was bringing this, she was like, tell people to have their tissues handy, because there are moments in that book for sure, but it's a great read.
If I'm not mistaken, that's how Anthony Bourdain got his start, was his first little article in the New Yorker.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was it called? Kitchen Confidential. He started a little column, I want to say, in the New Yorker. All right, Laura, thank you so much. If anybody wants to go see what's happening on the shelves of the Book Larder, go to booklarder.com and have a good time and support your local bookseller.
And with her events, too. There's a lot of good events on the website.
Okay. Up next, it's time
for... Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, brought to you by Rob with Love, is going to jam down in the next segment. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show. Last segment, it's the traditional time frame for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. It's brought to you by Rub with Love, small batch versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards that help the home cook develop layers of flavor in any meal. We make them right out there in Ballard at Sirius Takeout. Look for them in your local grocery store, specialty shops, or find them online at Tom Douglas, or my favorite online guy is your buddy Stan. He sells a lot of Rub with Love throughout the country and the world.
You know, you keep saying that, and I still haven't been to that site. I need to go see what's going on.
He sells guns, too. It's Rub with Love and guns. He's awesome.
Quite a combo.
Yeah, he's awesome. He's got about 20 products that he sells. Pamela, would you like to tell people? Oh, I forgot to mention, it's a surprise to both Terry and I that Laura Hamilton has stayed on the line from the Book Larder in Fremont. And so the tragedy of that, Chef, is that typically when Pam knows who the guest is going to be, she tailors the questions so that we get crushed.
I've noticed.
I've noticed
because at the break she said, the theme today is all on books.
Yeah,
that was before we found out Laura was staying. I'm like, great.
Basically, what we're saying is Pam is a cheater. Pam, who's our winner today, and how do you play the game?
Susan Peverly, for her incredible enthusiasm about Terry's story.
Oh.
And very enthusiastic. And our prize today, because of Labor Day being right around the corner, the ancho barbecue sauce, the pork rub, and the salmon rub.
What a nice combo.
I know. Carol did well by the winner.
Laura, when you lose, you have to pay for shipping, which is about $7.50. So you might want to save up, or you might want to hone your answers to a more winning.
We might have to trade some books.
Yeah. Okay.
We're starting the questions today with Terry.
Okay.
Cookbooks have been with us for a very long time. The oldest known cookbook was written on clay tablets and dates from the 18th century B.C. Which culture left it for us?
The Greeks?
The Babylonians.
Oh, they're right next door.
Number two, Mr. Rotaro.
Right.
This famous 19th century French aristocrat, painter, and alcoholic collaborated with Maurice Joyeux to produce his Art de Cuisine. Who was he?
I'm going to go with Matisse. Just to...
Toulouse-Lautrec.
Toulouse. Was the other one. Mm-hmm. The drunk pot.
It features grasshoppers grilled in the fashion of St. John the Baptist. Interesting.
Did St. John get grilled?
Number three. Who wrote The Naked Chef?
Who wrote The Naked Chef? That's a good question. The Naked Chef was written by... Dude. You know the answer, Tom?
Yes, Jamie Oliver.
Oh. Okay. Yeah.
You know what? I haven't read it, obviously.
You keep your clothes on when you're cooking, thank goodness.
You have to be naked to read it.
That's right. I obviously have not read that one. Sorry, Jamie.
Who was the French King of Chefs and Chef of Kings who published his... Guide Culinaire in 1903, which is still in use today?
Escoffier.
Yes, of course.
That one I know. It's a classic.
While she was living in France, after working for the OSS in the Second World
Julia
War...
Julia Child.
Yes.
Keep going. Oh, it's the end. Sorry. Okay, never mind.
Okay. So
two out of five. Two. Oh, my God almighty.
All right, Laura. Time for your torture.
Okay. Oh, my gosh. Given these questions, I'm a little worried.
Little is good.
Don't be. When this woman wasn't touring as part of her husband's rock and roll band, she was a cookbook writer in her own right. She was an ardent vegetarian once saying, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, the whole world would be vegetarian. Who was she?
This Linda McCartney.
Yay! Yes. Number two, who wrote Kitchen Confidential?
I think I got a little help.
He's not with us
any
longer.
Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah, yes. I love this one. Number three, what was the title of Isabella Beaton's 1861 work, which included tips on fashion, child rearing, servants, and animal welfare, as well as over 900 recipes?
So it should be a guide to household management.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mrs. Beaton.
I have a 1912 copy of that upstairs.
Do you
actually.
Really?
I do. Yeah. Wow. It came with someone's tax bill tucked inside it.
Wow.
Yeah. In a similar vein, whose 1896 Boston Cooking School cookbook has stayed in print for over a century and is often referred to only by the author's name?
I believe that's Fanny Farmer.
You are right. And screaming to victory, who wrote A Day at El Bulli?
I did not, but I was there.
Ferran Adrià.
Yay! 5 for 5. All right, Mr. Douglas.
Thank you, Pamela.
You're welcome.
And she was, like she said,
$7.50 later.
She said, I'm worried a little bit. Yeah, no, I know why now.
Number one, this cookbook by Irma Rombauer and Marion Rombauer Becker has become so familiar that its title was modified to become the title of a best-selling book by Alex Comfort. What is this cookbook's title?
The Joy of Cooking.
Yay!
Yes.
Number two, who wrote The Omnivore Dilemma?
Michael,
you're almost there.
I'm close enough.
Yes.
No.
You get half a point. For sure you get half a point. You get the first name right.
Michael
Pollen.
Yeah. Like the bees.
Oh, this is a good one. What is the cookbook Manifold Destiny about?
I don't get the question.
The Manifold Destiny of what?
Is that the name of the book, Manifold Destiny?
That is the name of the cookbook.
It's Cooking on Car Engines.
Yes! It is true.
Somebody actually wrote a cookbook of just cooking on car engines?
Yeah.
Wow.
I found that on Bon Appetit. It was really awesome. Number four, name a cookbook by Rick Bayless.
Boy, Topolobampo, Frontier Grill. I have no idea what his cookbook names are. He's got like 20 of them.
I would say my favorite Mexican cooking, homemade Mexican cooking.
Rick Bayless on PBS.
No.
Are you sure? Do you have all 20 book names?
No, I looked them up. Mexico, One Plate at a Time, Authentic Mexican, Fiesta at Rick's. Any others, Laura, that jump out for you by Rick?
It's like Mexico Easy or Mexican Easy or something like that, yeah.
So not one of his books talks about his restaurants?
No, he talks about food in his cookbooks. Who knew?
Okay.
Number five. Who is a better singer, Beyonce or Rihanna?
I would say Thierry. Yeah, because he does the best Louis Armstrong.
All right. Jerry's paying the shipping today.
It sounded like a lot of saliva back in that throat right there. Laura Hamilton from the Book Larder, thank you for being one of our contestants today. We appreciate you, even though you kicked our butt.
It was really fun. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. See you later.
If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on Facebook Live at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio, in case you hadn't noticed. And the show is produced by Pam Hinckley, Sean McFadden, and our editor is Sean, don't call me Dottori. Remember, if you miss any episode of Hot Stove Society Show, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening, and thank you for the memory over the last 35 years in this wonderful city.